a game open with his power, or win it with his legs, or preserve it with his defense. But because he lacked the pedigree that comes with a championship, and because he still seemed an awkward outsider trying to earn his pinstripes, he was regarded in his own clubhouse as not wholly reliable. "The two guys on this team we can't afford to lose are Derek Jeter and Jorge Posada," one Yankee player said after that second-day rainout. "Pitching is still the name of the game, but if you're talking about guys who are out there every day, we need those two guys. There's nobody to replace them, and what they mean to the team is so important." Alex isn't in that same category. He's important too, but I think we could survive if he got hurt. Of course, Rodriguez was the primary source of right-handed power in a left-hand dominant lineup and played terrific defense, so the Yankees could not come close to replacing his kind of value if he were hurt. Nonetheless, coming off his 1-for-14 performance in the postseason and his sometimes awkward clubhouse manner, his perceived value on his own team was less than his actual value. It was a very strange circumstance for a superstar talent. Fact is, these Yankees, whether they still belong to Jeter because of his captaincy or Swiss bank account of goodwill with Yankee fans, or to Rodriguez because of his talent and knack for creating attention, were still looking to craft an identity in their post-championship years. If the Yankees expected to win, it was only out of a perceived obligation to the past, not because they truly lived and breathed it. It took a repatriated Yankee such as Andy Pettit to recognize that kind of important shift in the Yankee culture. Pettit won world championships in 1996, 1998, 1999, and 2000 with the Yankees. He left reluctantly after the lukewarm effort by the Yankees to keep him following the 2003 World Series loss to Florida to sign with his hometown Houston Astros. After three seasons in Houston, one of which included another World Series appearance for Pettit, he jumped at the chance to come back to the Yankees, having missed the energy and demands that come with playing in New York. It had nothing to do with the city itself. Pettit almost never ventured into Manhattan. It had everything to do with the playing environment. The Yankees gave him back his old number, 46, his old locker, a spot along the right wall about halfway into the rectangular room, and his old default spot in the rotation, Pettit being the classic number two starter. He was, in fact, scheduled to pitch that second game of the 2007 season before it was rained out. Sitting at his familiar locker after the game was called, Pettit knew already that most everything else about the Yankees had changed in his 3 years away. These Yankees weren't sure who they were, didn't know if they were champions or not, and didn't truly believe, the way the championship Yankee teams believed, that they should win. "I have to be careful with how I say this," Pettit said. "But in the years we were winning here, we expected to win. Everybody. And when we didn't win, it was devastating. I remember 2003 wanting to win so badly. It was personal for me because I hadn't pitched well in the 2001 World Series, and Josh Beckett just took it to us in the World Series and shut us down. We had a great year, but I remember thinking how the year was such a failure. It was such a bitter feeling. Bitter." Just the memory of it pained Pettit. He dropped his head and actually grimaced, thinking about a 4-year-old memory, especially that last night when Beckett beat Pettit and the Yankees 2-0 in what would be the last World Series game ever played at Yankee Stadium. Only 7 men ever shut out the Yankees in a postseason game at Yankee Stadium, none since the Hall of Famer Warren Spahn did so back in 1958, and none struck out more batters than the 9 Yankees Beckett fanned that night. Pettit pitched courageously that night, allowing just 1 earned run over 7 innings, but he was the losing pitcher nonetheless. He hated even thinking about it. He picked up his head and continued. "And here's where I have to be careful," he said. "I think now we know how difficult it is to win. You have to be careful saying it because you don't want people to think you've lowered the expectations. The goal is still the same. But there's a different feeling now. It's a feeling that we know how difficult it is to win." By losing, the Yankees came to know how difficult the winning really was. And maybe now they know that reality a little too well. "Exactly," Pettit said. "That doesn't mean we want to win any less, but the expectation that we will win? That's different now than it was before. Jeter, meanwhile, remained wedded to the Yankees' old-school ways. He took losing hard and didn't tolerate those who did not. He still believed, despite the speech Torrey gave in spring training about being proud of 97 wins, that the 2006 season was a failure. "Maybe if it's a young team that never made the playoffs before, they can say it wasn't a failure," Jeter said. "Not us. Not me. To me, it's a failure if you don't accomplish what you set out to accomplish. Because you didn't reach the goal you set, it's not a success." "But wasn't there a point," Jeter was asked, "when even you realized that 2006 was a pretty good year, that the Yankees won as many games as anybody in baseball, even with many injuries and a slow start?" "No," he said, "not at all." That was the extent of his answer. It was as if the answer was so obvious that any explanation or expression of it was superfluous. 12 inches make a foot. There are 24 hours in a day. Any Yankees season that ends short of a World Series title is a failure. It was an immutable truth. Trouble is, as the Yankees roster churned in the 6 years since they actually had a self-defined successful season, more and more of the Yankees didn't think like Jeter. Losing now was a property of baseball nature that applied as much to the Yankees as it did the 29 other franchises, especially in the first 2 months of the 2007 season. The Yankees lost games with a frequency that ranked among the worst Yankees teams of all time. They lost 29 of their first 50 games, a disaster that would have been far worse if not for the spectacular hitting of the newly buffed Rodriguez. Only 5 other Yankees teams ever stumbled to a worse start, including only one in the past 93 years. The teams of 1905, 1912, 1913, 1914, and 1990. All of those teams finished with losing records, in 6th place or worse. The 2007 Yankees had disaster written all over them. After those 50 games, the Yankees' left-handed hitting, which figured to be the backbone of the offense, was atrocious. Abreu was hitting .228, Damon was hitting .260, and Giambi was hitting .262. None of them were yet in proper game shape. The back end of the rotation was hardly a surprise. It was as dreadfully unreliable as it had looked on paper. Egawa was so bad that after only 6 starts, the Yankees demoted him and his 7.63 ERA all the way to the Class A Florida State League, essentially to have Steinbrenner's gurus of pitching, Nardi Contreras and Billy Connors, give him a beginner's tutorial on pitching. It was mind-boggling to think the Yankees could believe he was worth a $46 million investment and then decide after only 6 games he needed to learn how to pitch. And Pavano? He was the pitching version of why New York State enacted a lemon law to protect used car buyers. He lasted through spring training and exactly 2 regular season starts before he was done for the season with an elbow injury. While the demises of Egawa and Pavano may have been predictable, Messina, Chenming Wang, and rookie Phil Hughes also wound up on the disabled list. Hughes pulled a hamstring in the midst of throwing a no-hitter. The Yankees immediately were caught with a shortage of major league-caliber replacements. In just those first 50 games of the season, Torrey was forced to use 11 different starting pitchers, 7 of them being rookies, and almost none of them with any significant future in the big leagues. One of them, Chase Wright, became the second pitcher in Major League history to serve up 4 consecutive home runs, which he managed to do in his second big league game in a span of just 10 pitches in Boston against the Red Sox. "Our problem right now is we have too many pitchers on the 15-day Pavano," Messina said one day in April. "That's what it's officially called now. Did you know that? The Pavano. His body just shut down from actually pitching for 6 weeks. It's like when you get an organ transplant and your body rejects it. His body rejected pitching. It's not used to it." Wins and decent pitching were so hard to come by that Torrey quickly reneged on a plan he announced on the first day of spring training, that Mariano Rivera would become a one-inning closer. Rivera was 37 years old, and Torrey figured he could ease the physical burden on Rivera if he never asked him to get more than 3 outs, which is the way most managers were pampering their closers. Rivera, though, sensed immediately that Torrey's plan would be subject to change. Rivera was one of the most valuable weapons in baseball, A guy not only with dominating stuff, but also with a freakish efficiency. He rarely went deep into counts, let alone walked hitters, that enabled him to secure more outs than your typical closer. He was a manager's best friend, the go-to solution to a problem. In case of emergency, don't break glass, pitch Mariano. We'll see, a skeptical Rivera said in March of Torrey's plan. I've heard those kinds of things before, and then it doesn't happen. It doesn't matter to me. I pitch when they tell me to pitch, and I'll be ready. But let's see. Torrey's plan lasted until April 21st, when one of those typically wild games at Fenway Park against the Red Sox created one of those in-case-of-emergency situations. The Yankees took a 6-2 lead into the eighth inning against the Red Sox when Torrey had Mike Myers, his left-handed specialist, pitch to David Ortiz, a left-handed hitter. Ortiz ripped a double. Then Torrey tried his right-handed setup man, Luis Vizcaino, against the right-handed hitting Manny Ramirez. Vizcaino walked Ramirez. Vizcaino did get J.D. Drew to ground out, but then Mike Lowell wrapped a single to drive in Ortiz. Now it was 6-3 with a tying run at the plate and one out. It was time for Torrey to junk his plan and go to his best pitcher. I lied. What can I tell you? Torrey would say after the game. I didn't plan on lying, but I did. As it turned out, he didn't pitch two innings. Rivera blew the lead. Jason Veritek singled to drive in one run, Coco Crisp tripled to send home two more, and Alex Cora dumped a bloop single over the head of Jeter to account for the last run of what was a 7-6 Boston win. For the Yankees, it was the start of seven consecutive losses, four of them to the Red Sox, including an 11-4 mugging at Yankee Stadium for loss number 7. It was April 27th, and Torrey was officially put on notice that his firing was imminent. Well, if you consider newspaper leaks as the official form of Yankees front office communication. Joe in jeopardy as Yanks bomb, the New York Post declared the next morning. Wrote George King, yesterday, the word out of Tampa was that Steinbrenner was very displeased about the way his high-priced stable of talent is underachieving and was thinking about a change. The story questioned whether Torrey was to blame for the woeful pitching and inept hitting, going on to say, if Steinbrenner and the voices he is listening to believe the answers are yes, and if the Yankees are swept this weekend by the Red Sox, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the boss could make a change. Translation, Torrey's job was in the hands of starting pitchers Jeff Karstens and Qianming Wang over the next 48 hours. It doesn't bother me, the leaks, Torrey said. It's an insult. If you have a problem, come to me. Being with the Yankees this long, devoting myself to the organization? Somebody doesn't like what you do? Then just tell me. Like in 2006 when I wasn't consulted at the end of the season. They left me hanging out there, and now I'm going to have a press conference, and I don't know if I'm working or not. Then I have George calling me 5 or 10 minutes before my press conference and telling me I'm coming back, and then I'm even playing the role. Thanks a lot. It's an insult because you think you deserve more than that. My wife tells me I'm overly sensitive, and I said, you're probably right. But there is a certain dignity to what you do. Again, as Allie pointed out, well, you know who you're working for. It's just the way they operate. And I didn't mind it when you win. And George still goes to the whip all the time. That's fine. You sort of grin at that and respect why he's successful and what he's made of. But there is a certain time you'd like people to trust what you do rather than question what you do. Karstens, with his third major league win, and what would be his only victory of the season, saved Torrey's job, pitching the Yankees to an improbable 3-1 win. The Yankees, though, reverted to form in the series finale, losing 7-4. They had won one game in the previous 10 days. Now it was time for Steinbrenner to weigh in, or at least the carefully managed version of Steinbrenner, rather than just the surreptitious whispers of the voices he is listening to. Steinbrenner's publicity people had stopped allowing him to speak extemporaneously to the press, whether in person or on the telephone. He rarely made public appearances. It was a public relations risk to have Steinbrenner be heard or seen, if only because it would spark more debate about his health and the succession of power. The boss would communicate with the media only through well-vetted statements released through the publicity firm, while officials from that firm or the Yankees front office continued to paint a picture of a robust Steinbrenner who, if you listen to them, was practically swimming the English Channel each morning and towing tractor-trailers with his teeth in the afternoons. Truth was, when Torrey would place calls to Steinbrenner, he no longer could get him at his office at Legends Field until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Steinbrenner wasn't coming to his office until then. "The season is still very young," the Steinbrenner statement said, "but up to now the results are clearly not acceptable to me or to Yankee fans. However, Brian Cashman, our general manager, Joe Torrey, our manager, and our players all believe that they will turn this around quickly. I believe in them. I am here to support them in any way to help them accomplish this turnaround. It is time to put excuses and talk away. It is time to see if people are ready to step up and accept their responsibilities. It is time for all of them to show me and the fans what they are made of. Let's get going. Let's go out and win and bring a world championship back to New York. That's what I want." It sounded like somebody doing his version of Steinbrenner, like one of those Hemingway writing contests for amateur authors, because, well, in times like this, Steinbrenner would be expected to say something, wouldn't he? It included the typical veiled threats. Cashman and Torrey, having been the only ones named, were thus considered to have been placed on notice that any blame would fall to them. And the football halftime speech platitudes Steinbrenner believed could make baseball players play better. But it lacked the authentic, from-the-gut fire and brimstone that made Steinbrenner such a fierce leader. Still, the statement was enough to fan more speculation that Torrey's job was on the line. "Every game we lost was a reference to getting fired," Torrey said. "It was like it was imminent. That's the way people were talking. As much as you try not to read the paper, you have all your friends and relatives reading the paper, and you can't shut yourself off. It was just wearing me out having to answer all those questions, and I'd go in the clubhouse and I'd have players say to me, 'You all right? You all right?' because of what was going on, and I hated that. You want everything nice. Win or lose, you want a clubhouse that's ready to compete, rather than having to sort of put stuff away first. And I was there 12 years. So there's a certain amount of respect that the players, even if they don't want you there as manager, that they feel they've got to show. It was just an uncomfortable time for me. The best part for me was the game. I didn't have to answer anything. I could just do what I knew how to do." The games were not all that soothing for Torrey. The Yankees had played only 23 games to the point when Steinbrenner issued his missive. They were 9-14, and had used 9 different pitchers to start those 23 games. 5 of those pitchers were rookies, and 4 of those had never before pitched in the big leagues, making the Yankees the first team since 1900 to use that many first-time pitchers that early in a season. Cashman was trying to help, but the assistance he provided only served to underscore a subtle philosophical gap that was opening between him and Torrey. Cashman would hand Torrey lineup suggestions, almost always basing them on statistics such as on-base percentage. "Do what you want with it," Cashman said. In one lineup, he suggested having Bobby Abreu bat leadoff and Jason Giambi bat second. Both were elite run producers, but Cashman's idea was to stack high on-base percentage hitters at the top of the lineup, whether or not they were traditional middle-of-the-order sluggers. Torrey generally disregarded the specific lineup ideas. Torrey liked some numbers as a tool, not as a philosophy. He liked to know, for instance, how hitters and pitchers did over the long haul against righties and lefties. So Torrey would politely thank Cashman for the suggestions and add a reminder for the general manager. "Brian," Torrey would say, "the numbers are good, but don't you ever forget the heartbeat." Cashman did make one suggestion that Torrey felt obligated to address immediately. "Why don't you pitch Mike Myers against right-handed hitters?" Cashman said. "He's been getting ground balls from right-handers. If you have a big spot where you need a double play against a right-handed hitter, why don't you bring in Myers?" Myers was a left-handed pitcher whose sole purpose in his baseball life was to get out left-handed hitters. He threw with a funky slingshot sidearm delivery designed specifically to create difficulty for left-handed hitters by increasing the angle from the release point of his throwing motion to home plate. The ball seemed to come sideways at left-handed hitters. The delivery, though, granted right-handers a long look at the ball. Over his career, right-handers pounded Myers for a .300 batting average, but lefties hit only .219 against him. The 2007 season was an anomaly for Myers, one in which lefties actually hit better against him, 295, than did right-handers, 259. Cashman was putting his faith in the small sample of numbers early in the 2007 season, numbers compiled largely in low-leverage situations, not the late innings of close ball games. "Brian, the only time we're letting him pitch to right-handed hitters is when we have wiggle room," Torrey said. "You have to look at the situations. He's not pitching to right-handed hitters with the game on the line." The Yankees were a mess. Steinbrenner really did have reason to be worried. His team was in full-blown turmoil, and it was not just because of the injuries. Damon, the leadoff hitter who once injected the Yankees with a goofy kind of energy, had become a drag on the team with his leg injuries and lackluster attitude. Once Damon made the decision to return to the Yankees after spring training, he still needed to get his legs in shape, but he was too far behind schedule for that to happen in time for the start of the season. Sure enough, on opening day, no less, Damon was drifting back on a fly ball by Elijah Dukes of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, a fly ball that would be a home run, when he felt a grabbing sensation in his calf. "I actually felt ready to go," Damon said. "And then opening day in 30-degree weather, why we play in New York then and not in Tampa, I don't know. On Elijah Dukes' home run, I felt my calf go. I was like, you gotta be shitting me. I kept playing through it. I couldn't get to balls. The team was losing because I couldn't get to balls. It was brutal. I kept trying to do something, but my legs wouldn't let me." For 2 months, Damon would brood over the condition of his legs, never getting the spark back in his desire to play baseball. There were days when he said he could not play, and days when he played when he did not seem enthused to be doing so. Back and forth it would go. Is he in the lineup or not? Does he want to play or not? Teammates grew frustrated. It didn't help either that Damon moped most of the time around the clubhouse. There was no more of that pregame joking in the clubhouse and the dugout. Damon presented Torrey with a multifaceted problem. There was the problem of putting together a lineup with the day-to-day nature of Damon's leg problems. There was the problem of Damon's lack of production when he was in the lineup. And there was the problem of Damon's teammates, especially the old guard Yankees, angry about Damon's lack of commitment. Torrey spoke privately with Damon from time to time and came away thinking Damon was in the same place he was when he walked away from the team in spring training. He was still waffling on whether or not he wanted to play baseball. Not exactly the kind of guy a sinking team needs as its leadoff hitter and would-be catalyst. In one of their private meetings, Torrey told Damon, "The kind of player you've been your whole life is the player who goes out there and fully commits himself. You're not that kind of player now. It's easy to see that." Damon agreed with Torrey. "I'm not sure I want to do this," Damon told him. Damon's teammates grew so frustrated with him that several spoke to Torrey out of concern that he was hurting the team. One of them visited Torrey one day in the manager's office and was near tears talking about Damon. "Let's get rid of him," the player said. "Guys can't stand him." Torrey told him, "I understand the way you feel, and I am disappointed too, and all of that stuff. But we've got to find a way to make it work instead of just walking away from it. We just have to. And you're going to have to help me find a way to get this thing straightened out." The easiest thing in the world, I mean, not that you could actually do it, is just get rid of him. You can't do that. We can't do that. So let's figure out a way to make this thing work. Listen, we've always had somebody here from time to time that we had to deal with, somebody we weren't crazy about. But we're doing badly right now, so that's why it may feel different. The bottom line is, he's a part of this team. And as long as he is a part of the team, it's up to all of us to find a way to make this work. Let's just do